We now have a quorum. I will call the meeting to order. And Representative Posh, you move the minutes.
I will move the minutes, Mr. Chair, April 15th.
Any discussion of the minutes? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And I have an announcement to this, not just to legislators, but to people in the audience. Yesterday, we received an action alert from the National Conference of State Legislators about the extension of the MA stimulus money for 6 months, which we have included in our budget already, $408 million. And that apparently is in jeopardy. So you should contact your legislators and senators and in Washington. I know Representative Carlson sent a letter to them yesterday, and we need to convince them how important that extension of that is, $408 million, because otherwise, we'll have to find $408 million of more cuts in Health and Human Services. Okay. Today, we're going to have some testimony on accountable care organizations. And these are integrated delivery systems that can combine both primary care and specialty care and hospital care, and attempt to make savings, and then they would get to keep some of the savings. There would still be insurance companies that would take the insurance risk. One of the problems we're having with the GAMC reform is that we basically turned the hospitals into insurance companies with that bill, and they can't sustain the risk that's involved. So that seems to be falling apart, but accountable care organizations would share in any savings with the insurance company that they can do. And you've all heard me talk too many times probably about the SMDC and Park-Niclet congestive heart failure program, and the fact that they lost $1 million by doing a really great job because they couldn't get paid for what they did, which was basically the nurses, nurse practitioners, and equipment for the people. So an accountable care organization, if they got a lump sum of money based on the illness level of their population, would then get to decide how to spend the money, and it would not be a fee for service. They would have the lump sum of money, and but the insurance company that's sort of on top of this would still be carrying the catastrophic risk. If they had a whole bunch of really bad cases that weren't really their fault, then the insurance company would take care of that. And we have a number. Let me just say the MedPAC, which is a group that advises CMS on Medicare, came out last June with a report on how to contain costs in the Medicare system, and they are strongly recommending accountable care organizations. There was a report last April, about a year ago, from a bunch of foundations in Minnesota. It's called Minnesota's Bottom Line. And part of that recommendation was also accountable care organizations. And so there's a lot of interest in that. And with that, we'll start with the testimony. And first we have Carol Backstrom from the Department of Health.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Backstrom, and I am the Assistant to the Commissioner for Health Reform at the Department of Health. It's a position I've been in for a couple of years, and my primary responsibility is for coordinating the implementation of the 2008 health reform law. And I'm happy to be here this morning or this afternoon. I think my understanding is that you'd like to hear a little bit more about what we understand to be the case in terms of the recently announced CMS demonstration project for Medicare Advanced Primary Care, or otherwise known as Medicare APC demonstration project. I have some information, some basic information for you about the demonstration, and I can just give you the information that we know at this point. I also have a copy of a letter that we have written, both Commissioner Ludeman and Commissioner Magnin has written to the director of CMS, or the director of the Medicare program at CMS, explaining some of the perspectives that we have from Minnesota on the terms in which we'd like to participate. So, as you may know, CMS, or HHS, I should say, came out with the announcement for the possibility of Medicare participating in advanced primary care demonstration projects in various states. APC, or advanced primary care, is also known as medical home, or as we all know it in Minnesota, as a healthcare home model. So this is really a chance for Medicare to come into Minnesota and participate in our efforts around healthcare home, which, of course, is a very intriguing concept for all of us. In terms of what Medicare has instructed states and what needs to be included, the states need to demonstrate that we have an effective medical home or healthcare home model already in place. And you know, as you all know, we're about a year and a half into the implementation of healthcare home in Minnesota, so we feel like we fit that requirement. We need to also demonstrate that a majority of the primary care physicians in the demonstration areas would participate. We need to have stringent requirements for the medical home providers, and we think that our certification requirements, as put forth in our rule that was recently released, would fit that requirement. And we need to be able to demonstrate that we're integrating public health services into the healthcare home project as well. We also need to secure the participation of a sufficient number of private payers in order to participate. So we think that we're pretty well positioned to apply for this demonstration. As you can imagine, we originally had heard CMS was going to be coming out with their RFP in the fall. It is now April. We still haven't seen anything. We understand that it's still working through the internal CMS process in terms of approval and release, including the OMB, the Office of the Management and Budget, in terms of pricing this out. It needs to be cost neutral, as you may all know. And we are expecting, as soon as that RFP does come out, probably about a 60-day turnaround in terms of the state's application back to CMS. We have several questions that have arisen in our conversations with stakeholders and our interest in applying. For example, we don't know how much flexibility there is going to be in terms of integrating this with other types of payment reform models. We're really hoping for some flexibility, and if I could actually have this passed out, I can just show to you that there were some points that we had made to the CMS. Thank you. The CMS director on the program, for example, that we are asking for some flexibility in the way we accomplish the program. Is it possible for us to take that medical home or that healthcare home model and grow that in time into more of a global payment model if we have willing participants, both providers and payers? We also don't know, for example, which Medicare products this might be including. Right now, we understand it's just Medicare fee-for-service, but it kind of begs the question of whether or not this includes Medicare cost or Medicare Advantage programs. And we also don't know things like the definition of substantial participation of providers and payers. Several unanswered questions. Certainly, we're concerned about the aspect of budget neutrality. As we all know, that in other demonstrations that have been done in Minnesota in terms of Medicare demos, it is actually, as to your point, Mr. Chair, in terms of providers figuring out how to do the right thing and saving money, can ultimately hurt them in the end. And we have been very clear with CMS that if Minnesota is going to participate, we do not want to be penalized long term in terms of being penalized in the form of lowering our base rates and that sort of thing. So we've made that pretty clear that that's one of the conditions for Minnesota's participation in the project. I can take any questions on the Medicare project, or if you'd like to hear any other comments on different where we are in health reform, for example.
Yeah, you might also want to talk about the May 18th event.
Sure.
And I'll probably be very tired when I'm at that one.
Mr. Chair, being that it's the day after session ends. Yes, we have, you may know, we've been participating in something called the Quality Institute, which is a Academy Health and Commonwealth-funded organization that has provided technical assistance to Minnesota in trying to move the quality agenda forward, as well as some payment reform and care redesign models. And so it's allowed us to gather some healthcare thought leaders and talk about things that we can be doing to enhance our health reform efforts in Minnesota. To that end, we are holding a meeting that includes the Quality Institute on May 18th. We're bringing in Harold Miller, who you might remember from the Transformation Task Force, to facilitate a discussion around sort of where are we going in terms of accountable care and or global payment type arrangements. This event is really intended to be a learning and sharing opportunity for payers and providers to come together. You know, oftentimes, you know, in our role at the state, we're asking ourselves what can we do to help facilitate these conversations. And one of the things I think we can do is convene thought leaders and CEO types and decision makers, those who might want to continue to explore this, to see if there are additional barriers or if there are ways that we can brainstorm around barriers and figure out sort of some of the necessary conditions for moving forward in different types of care redesign and payment reform efforts.
And just for the members' information, the Medicare fee-for-service is what's allowed in this potential pilot project. Is about two-thirds of the people in Minnesota are in that category. Some of them are into these Medicare Advantage plans, but most of them are in fee-for-service. And this is the first time that we will be able, if this passes, to start to pay, have any influence over Medicare and how we can do payment reform. And the importance of that is that Medicare is, I don't know, 20-30% of what we spend on health care in the country. And if you get that, plus you get MA, plus you get state employees and county employees, then you're close to a critical mass that would really change the way providers do what they do. And we would do the same thing we did in 2008, presumably, which is require that insurance companies offer these kinds of plans. They don't have to, not every insurance policy has to have that, but at least they have to offer one that does. And I would also, and we'll send this one around, the Commonwealth Foundation has just issued a report this month on what we did in 2007 and 2008. And so they thought enough about Minnesota to have an individual report about what Minnesota was doing. I do have some criticisms in there. So we'll send that around to you. And so are there any questions for Ms. Backstrom? Erin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Backstrom. I was skimming through your letter kind of quickly. And I think hopefully one of the testifiers coming up soon will be able to help us sort of put our hands around what we mean by accountable care organization. But as I have a concept in my head, it is not that we would pursue accountable care organization or a healthcare home, that they aren't one in the same or one disappears if we move in the other direction, but that the idea of care coordination or a healthcare home could advance the value of an accountable care organization and the savings to the system. Is that an accurate description from your perspective at the Department of Health?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, yes. You know, I think of sort of payment reform on a continuum, for example, and I think that healthcare home is a really good foundation for emphasizing primary care and care coordination. I think global payments or any kind of ACO type model is outside of that healthcare home model, but certainly lays the foundation for the work that we can do moving forward. And that's why we are still moving full steam ahead on our healthcare home model here in Minnesota, as well as, you know, I think the tools that we're putting into place, such as provider peer grouping, can be used moving forward. You know, for the first time, we'd actually be able to see, you know, a composite measure of both quality and cost for an entire population. And I think that type of system is going to really help us in the future and help organizations in the future think about themselves and how they think about overall population management.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. And you know, it's fun to talk about this. I just need a little help understanding something. I understand in a fee-for-service system that we would find some savings and probably quality improvements by having somebody care about the whole pot of money and the whole pot of quality. But as I look to the there's a bill in front of us. I was just reading that, which is kind of on the same topic. I thought the hope was that the HMOs would become kind of an accountable care organization. We give them a pot of money. We make it actuarially sound. And then we hope that they're going to look after it. And it seems as we expand these accountable care organizations to the state programs, which are already covered by HMOs, what's the difference going to be? What do we hope that will happen with this new management group the old management group couldn't do?
Commissioner Baxter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I'm not really prepared to speak to the language specifically, but I do think the concepts that are the issues that you're bringing up are valid. In looking at the language, you know, just kind of reviewing it, I think that there are a number of outstanding questions, I think your question being one of them. And at this point, I think it's we have a lot of work to do in terms of how we're going to define such an ACO, and I definitely hear from stakeholders in the community that there's a real desire for some flexibility, that we don't know what works quite yet, that it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, and I think we need to respect that and honor that. I think that what Representative Huntley is putting forth in terms of a discussion is also worthwhile in terms of trying to bring up all the different issues and how we might tackle them as a state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I'm eager to weigh into the discussion. You know, I just don't want to cause harm. I don't want to add one more layer of bureaucracy. And my observation from being part of all the health reform discussions that we've had since I got here, since cost seems to make a difference and we're worried about quality and access and all that, is that the people who have the money don't want to give it up. And so they're happy to reform somebody else. And they're happy to create accountability for somebody else as long as they don't have to change. And I think we've seen some pushback on the GAMC fix, gaps that it may have, because some people are fearful they're going to lose some money, even though they're going to lose even more money if they don't do it. And so I'm just, it's just interesting. And being a provider, it's an eternal vice that we're in, just trying to stay open. And so I can see it from a different perspective. But I hope that we can figure out that question. As I think the HMOs bring a lot to the table that they could use even more. Maybe they need more tools. I'm convinced, for instance, that the top 16% of all providers spend 35% of the money, and they like getting the 35%. And a lot of them are very influential politically. They're influential in their associations, whatever association, and they make money on state programs when everybody else works below cost because they do such a volume somehow. And I think if we don't get at that population somehow, be it through an HMO or a new accountable care organization, I just don't know how that we think some new group's going to clamp down on people that a group's as powerful as the HMOs. And I'm not criticizing them, but they carry a lot of weight with our bargaining. You want to be in, then you have to meet these criteria. If not, we're kicking you out. That's pretty well how they work with the small providers. And so with that kind of leverage, which is quite a bit still, they have a hard time containing the high-cost providers and the overutilization, what's called waste, which may even cause more harm to the people because you did more stuff and you should have left them alone. They wouldn't have needed some transplant or something. So I'm sincere in my question. We want to be sure before we design something else that we haven't redesigned another version that's not going to be productive and help us serve the people. So I guess that's not a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You have a comment, Commissioner? Okay.
No, thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I'm kind of building off of what Representative Abler just said, and I appreciate him bringing up the issue. But, you know, I go back to the early 90s. If we take the Wayback Machine back to the early 90s when the Clintons were looking at health care reform at the federal level, and we were doing some things here at Minnesota level, things you might be familiar with, like Minnesota Care and small employer insurance reform and some of those things. We came up with this concept, community integrated service networks, which were basically supposed to be small community-based HMOs. At the same time, we were vilifying a term we called gatekeeper, which when you break it down definition-wise looks an awful lot like what we mean by medical home now in more positive, you know, taking the same definition and putting a more positive tone to it. So you know, I go back to what we were doing in the early 90s. I see some similarities here, and so I have some of the same concern that Representative Abler is raising. Are we reinventing the wheel? Do we know how effective those things were? The community integrated service networks are kind of, I mean, it's still in statute, but we really don't see those as functioning entities very strongly in the state right now. And I'm wondering if we need to go back to that language and strengthen that model a little bit, because we may have, you know, three quarters of what we're looking for with those sorts of things. And then the other thing is kind of some baselining. You know, if those things didn't work or those ideas didn't work in the early 90s, how do we know that similar ideas we're bringing forward now are going to work? And the reason I raise that, and I don't know that we'll get an answer today, but we should be thinking about it as a committee, is we don't have a lot of time. Cost is going to be a huge factor. I know accessibility has been an issue we've discussed here. But we need to kind of get some of these things right, and we need to know whether we're succeeding or not. And that's going to require some understanding of what success looks like and doing some baselining. So whatever we're going to do, and I don't know that we know what that is yet, and you know, obviously you'll have your chance to answer here in a moment, but whatever we do, we need to know that it's moving us in the right direction, because we've tried some of these ideas before and they apparently haven't moved us where we need to go.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, I agree, Representative Gottwald. There's a lot of different models that we can consider, and I really sincerely hope that we can figure out how we can continue those conversations. I also feel like we're moving in the right direction, though, with the 2008 law and the implementation of the components from the 2008 law, because I really think that if you look at them as a sum of their parts, it's really a great building. It's a set of building blocks for which we can have some good, solid information for moving forward and making better, more informed decisions about our policies going forward. So I'd leave it at that.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. And next we have Michael Scandrett from the Safety Net Coalition.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. And as I believe the members know, the Safety Net Coalition is made up both of Safety Net hospitals who are getting some of the JMC money and outpatient community health centers, mental health centers, and others that aren't getting any of that money. And so it's a challenge for our organization to figure out you know, where we want to go from here. So my remarks today are both on ACO, but also relevant to the GAMC experience that's occurred over the last few weeks as the organizations have attempted to implement the coordinated care delivery system that was in the GAMC bill. The SafeNet Coalition would support moving towards accountable care organization models, and in fact more rapidly than you're currently thinking of doing that, and we see that as a potential solution not only to the GAMC challenges but also the even greater challenges that are lying in wait in a couple years if we aren't able to get costs under control. And there's a lot of different views of what an accountable care organization means, and part of this whole experiment is to figure out what methods work best to control costs while improving quality of care and improving the health status of members. But the common element of all accountable care organization definitions are the idea that a group of providers would take some level of financial risk for controlling the quality of care and the total cost of care of the patients that they serve. So the key elements are taking financial risk and being responsible for the total cost of the care, not just the portions of the care that a specialist or primary care provider or a hospital might provide. There are very good questions about the whether this is managed care or not. Is it recreating managed care? Is it creating something new? And I think the fairly strong consensus among those that have been looking at the issues is that one of the missing elements that's not occurring, and that I believe that the health plans in Minnesota are beginning to experiment with a little bit, but it's the lack of incentives at the provider level for those physicians, those hospital staff, other people that are making decisions they are stuck in a system currently where their financial survival as an organization depends on them providing more service and the most complex service possible, because that's where the money is. And the incentives are not to provide primary care or to try to keep patients healthy. And as you pointed out, the examples have been given before that if you do too good of a job of keeping your patients healthy, your hospitalization rates are going to go down, and that's where you get your money as a healthcare provider organization. And so the problem is the current fee-for-service-based system that exists both in managed care and in the traditional fee-for-service payment models, that still contains that very important disincentive for providers to do what they now know they could do that would improve the health of their patients and reduce costs. But by doing it, they're basically putting their organizations at risk. So again, a combo care organization is the idea of taking risk for the total cost of care of those patients and being willing to be held accountable for keeping the cost below a certain target for that group of people. Healthcare homes can be viewed as a tool that accountable care organizations might use, but in itself is not sufficient. The idea of a healthcare home is that there is a place where every patient can go to for questions, for care, and that's a single source of both information for them and assistance to them in using the healthcare system and coordination of all the different care services, drugs, and other things that are needed, not only for their treatment, but also for their personal health. So the idea that Minnesota has, and it's a really important step, is that right now we don't pay anything for that. That's a valuable service that benefits us all. So we're moving towards a way to pay for that service to a healthcare home. But the amount of that payment still is relatively small. And, you know, an example, the federally qualified health centers, there are many of them that have concluded that the cost for them to become a healthcare home is greater than the payments that they're going to receive from payers for being a healthcare home. And other providers find that same situation. If you're in a healthcare system that has a hospital and the healthcare home in it, it's still the same bind. The small amount you receive for those extra services, it makes you more effective at losing money in the hospital side and in the emergency room, and you're not going to be inclined to do that unless you have a different payment system. So you can't get there with just healthcare home. You have to add to that changes in the way providers are paid so that the payment system rewards them for doing the things that they know they could do better and we all know would improve the health of patients and reduce the cost of care, but they're stuck in that current system. So without that payment reform, you don't get to the goal that you're trying to get to. And so this kind of brings to the concept of the general assistance medical care solution. And, you know, definitely the governor's veto and his insistence on reform in the general assistance medical care bill has triggered a very high level of work to develop more efficient and effective methods of providing care to this population. That's occurred in the last year. And so those who are seeking to become the coordinated care delivery systems are finding ways they can reduce costs and manage care better, putting those in place. But 37 cents on the dollar is still, even with that, they're struggling to find a way that this can make sense for them, despite knowing that that there's an opportunity to do better than they would have before. So if we were still on the old amount of spending on GAMC, we definitely could be looking at some substantial savings off that. But because we're now at such a low base on that spending, the amount is not enough to generate even enough revenue to pay for those basic services. And any savings that can be realized for reducing hospitalization rates, all they do is reduce the loss that those organizations experience. They don't create any incentive for them in any other ways. So what I wanted to do today is suggest that there might be a way for the governor to achieve his objectives and the legislature to achieve their objectives using concepts that are already built into the reforms and intended to be done eventually, but to do them at a faster pace and in a broader scale than you're planning to do. And so just for consideration is the idea that of doing true accountable care organizations across all the state programs, not just on GAMC. That gives you the potential for a much greater level of savings off the total pot of money, and by generating more savings, then that gives you more money to support the GAMC population so that they can receive more care than they can under the current system. The work that people are doing right now is heading in the direction that I think in a matter of 6 months that organizations could be prepared to make commitments. And part of that is driven by past experience that I've had working with a coalition of Minnesota's largest health systems about in 2007 to prepare a proposal to the federal government for a Medicare demonstration project. And we didn't know enough to call it an accountable care organization at that time, but it was basically a healthcare home with payment reform. And under that project, I forgot the number, but six or seven health systems were willing to take financial risk for controlling the total cost of care of their patients and to make that commitment to CMS in contract in return for being given flexibility so that they could direct the resources that they do receive towards the services they knew that they could provide more effectively to keep people healthy and wouldn't be totally penalized by reducing the hospitalization rates because they'd have enough of the shared savings that they could use to prepare themselves for changing their emphasis in their organization away from inpatient to primary care. So that was in 2007, and since that time, the tools and the knowledge has greatly advanced and puts both the state and the health systems in a much better position to achieve that goal of reducing total cost of care through a combination of healthcare reform and payment reform. And I think previously the discussion and Commissioner Backstrom speaking to the opportunities that the federal government has created, and this was not part of the reform bill but part of a previous effort that CMS announced that they would be willing to bring Medicare to the table with state health care programs as a way to leverage a larger payer mix. And so the concept that I'm encouraging you to consider is the idea if we could get Medicare, Medicaid, GAMC, Minnesota Care, all into a system that pays with the right incentives for providers, the potential for savings would be substantial. And I think it's possible that the savings achieved by the end of the next biennium would be sufficient to pay for the cost of keeping people in GAMC until they can be enrolled in an accountable care organization. You can't do it in 2 months, or I guess we're running out of time. It's not even 2 months left. There's a lot of work that being done, but June 1st isn't realistic if we're going to do the kind of effective changes that need to be made. So kind of the short conclusion, again, is not to to get away from what's attempted to be accomplished in the GAMC bill, because the idea of those strong provider incentives is a really important one. But you go too far with incentives, you don't have any money left to provide the care. And so by pooling the money with the other programs, it should be more realistic to expect that the provider organizations would be willing to do a project, be willing to commit to a certain level of savings off those projects. And then in terms of the relationship between the health plans and the provider organizations, I don't think it necessarily needs to be determined one way or another what those roles would be. The point is to have something in the system that creates incentives at the provider level that both encourages them to do the right thing but also gives them the flexibility with the money that they receive so that they're able to shift the money where it should be spent and avoid taking major losses due to their success in reducing hospitalization rates. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Just before we get to the questions, Mr. Skander was talking about the 2006-2007 attempt to get a CMS waiver, and that involved Senator Durnberger, and it actually involved large delivery systems from Wisconsin all the way across to Minnesota, North, South Dakota, and Montana even. So it was a big thing. And the interesting thing is, if you remember my blue and white map, that all those states were white, except for Montana was light blue. That was the high quality, low cost states. Okay, questions for Mr. Skandret. Representative Abert.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One, you mentioned the GAMC thing. what's been your experience with the outreach from the groups that are considering being CCOs to your network, and how do you think they would be used in any of those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, in the Coordinated Care Delivery System project, or are you thinking broader in the...
With the latest, with the contracting going on now with the GMC proposals and those who would participate or not?
Sure. I'm not going to speak for any of those individual organizations. I can tell you that it's a very difficult decision to be made because I don't think those organizations could do justice to their organization, their responsibility, their organization, to go forward with a coordinated care delivery system unless there are sufficient additional provisions in the contract or in the law that limit their total exposure to a level that they can handle. And the example being that I think when the bill was passed, it was envisioned that there would be coordinated care delivery systems scattered throughout the state and that people who had been on GAMC would have some place that they could go to get at least a basic level of care. As it's turned out, there's only four hospitals in the metro area that are still in discussions with the Department of Human Services. What that causes then is that everybody else in every other part of the state, if they need medical treatment, that either the local providers who used to treat them and get paid for it will have to provide them treatment without getting paid for it on a very large scale, or else those patients will need to come down and sign up for one of the coordinated care delivery systems in the Twin Cities area. If these coordinated care delivery systems have to accept 2, 3, 4 times the volume of patients that they used to treat under GAMC for the same pot of money, they're not going to be able to do that. And so the dilemma is they either will need to have some limitations so that they're able to move forward with the project. And if they do that, then we have a lot of people in the state that will no longer have coverage and no longer have a place to go where their care could be paid for. But if you don't limit their obligations, then there will be such demand they won't be capable of moving forward. And I'm not saying that anyone is or is not going to move forward at this time. Negotiations are underway, and I think they understand what they need to have happen in order to be able to move forward with the project. But I'm just saying it would be nice if we were able to come to some alternative that the governor would support that would maybe be more meaningful and substantial reform, achieve the same level of savings, and not leave people or providers in this temporary position of a very difficult situation occurring across the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
That was a good answer, but maybe I wasn't clear in my question. But I appreciate your opinion on that topic. I'm just curious what outreach has been made to your safety net clinics from any of those hospitals. My desire was that they would work closely with you with these populations that you're serving thousands and thousands of.
Okay.
And so I would expect that the cheapest way to serve them would be to have you as the front line. I thought that would have been a good idea to have that anyway. But are they talking to you guys about, since you're the street level providers?
Well, the Safety Net Coalition is an association of the providers.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of communication among those who deliver care to the patients that were formerly on GAMC. There's a lot of important parts of the safety net system for serving GAMC patients, and there is communication going on. The problem is that the amounts that the hospitals would receive won't even cover their losses on their inpatient hospitalization, and there's no provision in the bill for payment to those other clinics, the primary care clinics. So yeah, the discussions are, you know, how far are you willing to go in the outpatient clinics to keep serving the patients that used to be on GAMC without receiving payment rather than referring them down to the hospital to get their care there. And, you know, just you're asking very difficult decisions to make that there's not enough money to share with them, but by them choosing to serve the patients without payment, they put their own organizations at financial risk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was my first question.
Okay, Representative Abler.
And the second one, Ken, you mentioned about the same thing I asked Ms. Backstrom. So what do you think we should do different if we do these mega ACOs and combine? I can understand where there might be some money in Medicaid, in Medicare fee-for-service. I don't know where the money is in the HMO already served populations. They tell us they live on a narrow margin, and admin is already around 6 or 7% net, and the rates they pay providers are, you know, marginal rates anyway. So tell me how, if we create a new ACO or whatever you call it, of made up with a lot of these same people, where are the savings going to come from that would make this to be a money machine?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the first step and the most important step is to reduce inpatient hospitalization and emergency room use for dealing with crisis and major emergencies. There is evidence and a strong expert opinion, really pretty widespread now, that we could do a better job of that. We could improve the health of the patients. We could improve the management of chronic conditions, end up with a better outcome for the patient while dramatically reducing the inpatient hospitalization rates. That's where the savings occurs. But again, currently, the incentives are to the opposite of that. And as you squeeze down the payment rates for providers, their only choice in order to stay viable is to provide more, try to provide more care. So you increase the volume. So you don't get anywhere with cutting the provider rates. Then you cut the provider rates further, and you reach the point where providers may not even be willing to serve people. And again, I think that people feel that there's enough money in the system that you could serve people well and reduce costs, but you would have to change the way the payments are made and the incentives for the providers in order to do that.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a lot of different thoughts running through my head on this whole GAMC thing now. And to the testifier, Mr. Chair, right now the legislation we've got, the changed bill that we put together that Representative Murphy and Representative Dean were involved in putting together, you've got kind of a tale of two states. You've got the metro area that's capable of doing CCOs, it would seem, and then you got the rest of the state. The vast majority of GAMC recipients are in the Twin Cities metro area, and the rest are scattered around the state. And so you've got the possibility of CCOs functioning in the Twin Cities area. It's reasonable to think you could put together the systems and the accountable care payment approach in this area, but maybe not in the rest of Minnesota. Then you got fee-for-service. If we do transitional MA and we cover GAMC recipients under medical assistance, but we still want to do the accountable care model, do we need a waiver? I know there's some language built in there about payment, the 90% payment around these, but do we need to do anything else? Do we have to suddenly exempt ourselves from the federal reforms if we take that option? Maybe I'm looking for clarification from either Mr. Scandretta or yourself, Mr.
Chair. Well, let me start out. My understanding is there's still the insurance company there, and that the accountable care organization gets their money from the insurance company. And if they make savings, they get to keep part of the savings. The insurance company would probably get part of the savings. And this is already occurring in Minnesota. Medica has a large number of their enrollees in these kinds of organizations in the Twin Cities. And I don't think they've gone quite as far as accountable care organizations, but they certainly are on the way, and some of these are operating. And whether or not Medica has a lot of MA people, and I assume, but I don't know, and I don't know if they're here, that some of those are probably already in that. So I don't think you need a waiver to do that. But Mr. Scandrett would know better than I do.
I don't know about that. But Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, under the CMS kind of information that's been provided about the expansion of the Medicaid that would allow the GAMC population to be enrolled, the process is for a state plan amendment be submitted in June for those states. There's 11 states like Minnesota that have the early opt-in option. If that state plan amendment is submitted with these components to it, then, you know, they'd be incorporated for Medicaid and the GAMC people as they would be transferred over, and has that added benefit of the federal match back to April 1st of this year on the GAMC payments that have already been paid to a certain extent. And so there's a combination of that early opt-in authority plus the primary care initiative that was mentioned early, plus other provisions that would make it possible for Minnesota to do something like this across all programs, including Medicare. You have to do some persuading with CMS, but at least they say they're eager and they have the authority to do it, so that by June you could submit a proposal for doing that, hopefully get CMS approval, and be, you know, ready to move forward with the cost containment features of it. And in the process be able to keep people in a program long enough to get the ACOs together and get people enrolled in the ACOs. And again, if all this could be accomplished, then you could achieve the same level of savings that you would achieve by not having the program in the short term, but you'd achieve it over a long period of time and over a broader base of programs.
Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And not so much a question, but a comment based on the testimony from Mr. Scandrett and then from Commissioner Backstrom, and that both the CCO model of reform, which, you know, is fairly conceptual and probably not as articulated as I had hoped it would be, and the healthcare home, which we've worked on for a couple of years, it's been through the rulemaking process, et cetera, so that's a well-articulated process. In both cases, they're voluntary, and the providers have the choice of participating or not. And in both cases, I'm hearing, thank you, probably not going to participate, but we'll still take care of the patients, which creates an interesting paradox, I think, for policymakers. One of the issues that I don't think we ever really reached a conclusion about in the GAMC debate, which was what is the right amount of money, right? And as Senator Berglund liked to say all the time, this is really just about money. This is a debate really in the end about payment. And if we pursue this idea, and I will tell you I'm very intrigued by this idea, I am leaning in the direction of thinking we can't make this a voluntary participation, because I think we need to make sure the enrollees in GAMC and medical assistants are getting good care. I want to make sure we do that, but we also have an obligation as policymakers to slow the cost growth in our public programs. And if we pursue and embrace ideas that we think are going to yield better care and a savings to the system, but people don't participate because they don't like the payment rate, we're not going to achieve the savings. We're just going to spend the money in a different place. So as we go forward with this discussion, yet this session, which I think is really important, and in the sessions ahead, I think we're going to have to be more clear and determined about the need for us to drive costs out, wring costs out of the system using some of these reform mechanisms.
Okay, other questions? Mr. Scandrett.
Mr. Chair, just I forgot I hadn't responded to one of Representative Gottwalt's comments, and that is about the rural communities, and there are definitely models out there. They're different than how we've done in the metro area, but there are definitely models that would be workable in rural communities, and that I think would be embraced by communities that would be willing to do it. But it would be very important not only to incorporate that, but also have sufficient flexibility in the ACO models so that even differences in communities can be addressed, because healthcare is very local, and if you haven't created a system based on the local providers and the local needs, it's not going to be responsive. And I think that's one of the problems we have with the current system, is the inability to be responsive to the local needs and circumstances, and so that would be an important part of it.
Representative Gottwalt.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Scandrett, that's one of my concerns. I'd love to hear more about those models. Maybe we can do that at some other point, talk about metro versus outstate Minnesota, because I think that issue has been wrapped up here both in the current GAMC solution as well as the early MA. But how do you make it work, and how do you make it work under a one-size-fits-all approach? Granted, if the state applies for the early MA, we've got some flexibility in our application, but if we haven't got these models full-fledged in that application, where is the flexibility? Are we able to do the things we need to do to deliver the new model, whatever that's going to be, of care to these people. Because we know from this entire discussion about GAMC that the way we're doing it now, or prior to now, has not been serving them well, and it's been costing us too much. So what's the new way to do it right, and will there be sufficient flexibility under either of our approaches to get that done in both the metro area as well as outstate? That's my concern.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say that it's a lot easier for the big systems, health systems, where the clinics and the doctors and the hospital are all in one group to do this. The question is, what do you do when you have a small town with two different clinics and the hospital, and they're not attached to each other?
Well, Mr. Chair, in a previous life, I was responsible for helping to put together networks in those outlying areas, and I can tell you, I know exactly what you're talking about. You got a two-doc shop in some small town. They may be 20, 30 miles from the nearest hospital. How do you create systemness and hold them accountable for the total cost of care? That's what we have to be concerned about.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when you talk about one segment of the population and the Medicaid and so on, it's one thing, but the GAMC population is such a unique segment that they don't really kind of fit into some of the other things. Plus, the issue is that if they get moved into Medicaid, my understanding is the costs just go through the roof because of the expansion of services and everything else. But it seems as though that the coordinated care, accountable care for them in our GAMC, the new approach to it was to have kind of a coordinated care wrapped around them, that really seemed to be one of the good things about it. I think what I heard St. Cloud talking about is what made it very difficult for them is they didn't know how many they'd be expected to take care of for what dollar amount. Well, yes, of course. I think that would be an untenable situation to be in. And in that, you know, that they're saying no. But I think if we fix some of those things, it may still work. Because I think for that particular population, there needs to be a more of a customized or set approach. I don't know exactly all the language, but I think we might want to consider dividing those two, because otherwise they sink each other. They just kind of don't fit real well.
Well, I will say that the one thing I've learned in 18 years here is certain groups need things that are different than other groups need. And if you're talking about middle-class people, you've got one set of circumstances. When you're talking about the GAMC population, my view is you cannot separate the social service things that they need from the health care. You just have to have that integrated together, or it won't work for that population, but which is completely different than what the middle class might need. Okay, any other questions? Representative Abler.
Thanks. This is, I think, a very productive discussion, and I think a good witness to talk about it with, so I won't be so chatty probably later. But I hope that these plans that come forward include the use of you guys, you know, the kind of clinics you are, where you have 6,000 or more current patients in the GAMC roles. And I'm concerned if some of the proposals, even though there's only a few potential proposers, don't include using you heavily. To me, it seems that you've found a way to make the dollars go as far as they can and actually eliminate the need for hospitalization, much as you suggested. And so I hope that's my wish. I know when the bill says may use you guys, but I think they ought to, and I think they would be foolish in trying to contain their own costs, thinking they can recreate that in a big building setting when you are scattered around where the clients hang around. I just have a question. Back to your other saving money through the ACO thing, you thought that they could do less hospitalization? I'm still stuck on the question. It seems to me that the HMO is currently making every effort to reduce hospitalization, and do you think that they could somehow that an ACO, whatever that's going to be, could leverage some clinician from not hospitalizing people so much, or do you think a lot of it was inappropriate, or they really shouldn't go in the hospital in the first place, and the HMOs haven't got the power to say no?
Mr. Skandrat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't want to speak for the health plans, and I know that they there's so many things we have in our system today that are the result, good things that are result of what's been done. What I hear is more from the provider side that if they were paid differently, they could achieve this goal. And I don't not want to say, you know, who's right or wrong in terms of how these negotiations have occurred between the health plans and the providers, but I would bring one piece of experience back from my background when I was the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And while I was there, we did establish the community measurement program that reports comparative quality on the providers. And a really important decision the health plans made at that time is that sometimes if each health plan has a different method of managing costs, it's the providers give up because every patient that comes through the door, there's a different set of rules. And that what the health plans concluded is that on quality, we need all the providers measured against the same quality measures rather than each health plan having a different set of measures. I think there's some balancing of this at work here. I think what we want at the provider level is a framework that allows the physicians and the hospitals and providers to treat every patient in a way that will result in efficient care and good quality care. If we have different systems depending on where you get your insurance, you're never going to see the kind of changes that need to take place because you have to look it up or you have to figure out for each patient what the appropriate protocol is there. And what we hear from the providers is they think they know what they need to do. They'd like to be able to do that, and they'd like to be paid in a way that allows them to deliver care in a way that will reduce costs because it'll keep their patients healthier. And so that's the I think the missing ingredient there. But again, I'm not speaking for the health plans.
And Mr. Chair, I just think he's a great witness because of all his hats he's had in the past, and there's even more hats than that. But I you know, as we look forward to reform something, it doesn't just mean change it because it's different. And you know, education is full of ideas that every new 5 or 10 years they come up with a new way to do it, and then it just gets messier. And I think healthcare is kind of like that. But I'm just asking the questions. You know, we have a relatively healthy HMO system in Minnesota that some argue could be expanded to more, you know, interstate or not, or all these ideas we think of. But, you know, if there's some fundamental behaviors that we have to get after on the parts of the clinicians and confusion and whatever, maybe we need to look at that if that's the real answer. And if some hospitalizations are inappropriate or some treatments are inappropriate, and their peers don't agree, then somehow we have to get the peers to say, no, that was inappropriate. You know, and especially as we face $5 to $8 billion of shortfall, a lot of which is going to fall right in our department here if we aren't careful. And so that's just I won't drag it out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Next we're going to go to Dr. Bob Wieland from Alina.
Tell Danette that you want to have her.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Wieland, and as a physician, I've spent 15 years practicing internal medicine. I'm currently the executive vice president for the ambulatory care at Alina. An important part of my job is to make sure that all the components that make up Alina are physicians, nurses, our facilities, clinical and non-clinical staff are aligned to deliver exceptional care at the right place, at the right time, and for the right price. I'm pleased to be here today to provide an overview of the work that we're doing to prepare for the future that includes accountable care organizations. Just a little background. Alina is a health system. We have 11 hospitals, 70 clinics, emergency medical transportation, home care, hospice services, that provide care to 1 in 3 Minnesotans each year. But we're not yet a fully clinically integrated care system. One of our challenges, and I don't think most people know this, is that on our collective medical staffs, we have 5,000 physicians. 1,200 of those are employed by us. 3,800 are independent. And that creates challenges when you're trying to have the kind of clinical integration that you need to be an accountable care organization and accept risk. We are charging quickly and thoughtfully toward new models of care and payment, starting with clinical integration, which I'll speak to in a moment. With healthcare payment trends and recently passed reforms, we expect to see a mix of the following changes over the next several years. A movement away from fee-for-service and toward value-based payments, a shift of risk to hospitals and physicians for total cost of care, reimbursements for care linked to providers' performance, payments that reward high quality at lower cost, or bundling episodes of care together under a single payment, and consumers who are becoming increasingly educated about healthcare options and sensitive to price. But the fragmented system that we have today offers limited support for the kind of care coordination that will be necessary to deliver the successes for patients and payers in these new models tomorrow. Through the development of a clinically integrated network, we will focus on creating better patient outcomes, better patient experience, and better value. It's important to understand that payment reform and models like accountable care organization are not at their core about changing how we're paid. It certainly involves that, but they're really about changing how we provide care for the patients. In the past, a patient that presented with asthma, cancer, and depression would likely be referred to three different care providers based on specialty. Likely, there would be little or no coordination in their efforts to treat these very different health issues. With the advent of care improvements such as the electronic health record, care navigators, team care, providers are able to collaborate on all aspects of their patient's care. Providers and specialists are able to make decisions based on the whole patient, not just the piece and parcel that's their focus. Coordination of care, treatments, and medications will provide improved outcomes and cost savings. In addition, clinical integration will focus on quality and value. Working across Allina with independent physicians, the 3,800 that I referenced earlier, will identify and deliver on the greatest opportunities for quality and cost improvement. We believe that a clinically integrated network, different than an economically integrated network of the 90s, will provide one shared infrastructure for delivering care. It will standardize care outcome expectations as well as the measurement of those outcomes. It'll allow us to pool resources, it will give us a mechanism for dealing with payment reform, and perhaps most importantly, it will assist us in changing physician behaviors to optimize quality outcomes and value. We know there are barriers to integration, including time and money, but access to the best practice data is not a barrier. We know what works to improve patient outcomes. The trick is hardwiring it into every patient encounter, changing physician behavior. Beyond Allina, our patients and the physicians who provide their care, there are other key stakeholders. We need to partner with payers, the state, and other providers to address the challenges to establishing successful innovations like ACOs. The challenges we face with healthcare reform will include aligning payment methods across payers. This was mentioned in earlier testimony. Change of this scale will occur in segments. How do we transition from here to there while limiting unnecessary waste and administrative expenses or care model redesign? Secondly, picking and setting the right pace to change our delivery system. As we move from fee-for-service to value-based care, how fast do we go? This is why we're starting with clinical integration. Delivering the best outcomes and the best patient experience at the best price will fit in either the fee-for-service or value-based model. Addressing key issues for the transition is the third element. Will we have the providers we need to deliver care? I think if you look at Massachusetts reform, the first thing that they ran into was enormous access issues to primary care. How will we address the access issues that will surely present themselves? How will we reconfigure capacity to support the right care at the right place? Will we have the ability to share and exchange data and information to support true care coordination? Throughout the community and within Allina, talk to 100 people and you'll likely get 100 different perspectives on health reform. But talk to 100 people at Allina and you'll hear only one perspective on health care. We all want to deliver the best outcomes and the best patient experience at an affordable price. That's our mission, and it's why I'm here today. Allina's learned a lot about clinical integration, and we have a long way to go. We want to share our experience with others and help shape the future of healthcare in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I welcome questions.
Thank you. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Whelan. I know when Allina first came into being, it was kind of an interesting model, very intriguing. People say, you know, big hospitals, lots of clinics, and a health plan for the risk and the financial piece. And I know that was a difficult birthing process for that organization. Got to see some of it myself. But that systemness, which we now see with some of the other health plans in the state, and I go back to my comments earlier about two states. You got what's able to be done here in the Twin Cities with a lot of critical mass hospitals, clinics, and the risk model is very much here with large numbers. And then what's happening in the rest of Minnesota, and it seems, going back to the CISN concept, I look at what happened, for example, with Central Minnesota Group Health Plan, and Central Minnesota ended up needing to really partner with health partners in order to be viable in a rural or at least a smaller community. How do you see organizations like Allina helping make these bullet points you talked about on your first page of your comments here work in the rural settings, the smaller communities throughout Minnesota?
Dr. Whelan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I think, listening to the earlier testimony, I think the rural setting is challenging, and it really depends on what's going on in the local community. I think we've got communities where the hospitals and physician groups are quite integrated and collaborative and really could have the foundation to be able to accept risk and work together to reduce costs and improve quality. I think we have other rural communities where they're quite at odds with each other, and that would be very difficult to achieve that kind of collaboration.
I would just say, Wilmer is integrated, the clinic and the hospital. Detroit Lakes is recently integrated. Brainerd has recently integrated their systems.
Right.
So they're starting to move that way as well. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm surprised you didn't mention Duluth, by the way.
Well, I don't consider that rural.
I guess I'm thinking, I realize you're speaking for Allina, not maybe the other organizations, but we have these strong healthcare entities or systems in the Twin Cities area and in some other parts of the state. But the experience with CISNs has shown us that even in some of the regional centers where we've got risk-bearing systems, that risk-bearing is pretty tenuous, and one or two major cases could really throw them overboard. And so I'm trying to get at, how do you see yourselves maybe being kind of a strong, stable partner for rent, if you will, to kind of strengthen these more tenuous systems in outstate Minnesota?
Yeah, well, I think in general is the squeeze on healthcare reimbursement comes, and it undoubtedly will, to hospitals and physicians, you'll see consolidation, either through partnership, strategic partnership, or out-and-out acquisition. So I think we're not that far away from the burning platform to kind of make people change. I think many smaller communities are strongly independent. It's not their desire to be anything but independent. It's my personal opinion, not Alina's opinion, that I think when the squeeze comes, you'll see nationwide consolidation.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Whelan, I appreciate your comments, and probably in your testimony here, there was a line that you said, and Mr. Chairman, I have a question, and then I have a follow-up, if that's okay, that Allina has learned a lot about clinical integration. And so I'm intrigued by, can you give some bullet points or some little more detail there about what you mean by you've learned a lot? And I know you have a long way to go, so I'm not expecting a final answer here.
Right.
Dr. Whelan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, a couple of points there. One, while we employ 1,200 physicians, we certainly don't have the spectrum of specialists. So the integration that we've done around community measures and around core measures, we've learned a lot about how to drive results. I would say the other point that I would want to make about what we've learned thus far is we've been on a path now for a little over 6 months learning about a clinically integrated network. And there are other examples across the nation. In Chicago, Advocate Physician Partners is a clinically integrated network. And Peachy in Boston is another example. There's quite a number of them across the nation. And it's a vehicle, it's a legal structure that allows independent physicians, hospitals, and employed physicians to come together and take risk if that's where you want to go together and reward. It's a vehicle where you can share savings if you're working on total cost of care. And it's a vehicle where you can share in performance. So we're hoping that this sometime later this year that we would launch that organization. So that's what that statement referenced.
Let me ask, do those kind of organizations run into antitrust rules?
If they're not done carefully, and Mr. Chair, excuse me, I think they were defined in '98, the clinically integrated network. With the fall of managed care in the late '90s, and economically integrated networks really had no reason for being any longer. Up from that came clinically integrated networks, and the FTC has ruled on. I think they've got five letters, position letters now, on what are the elements to allow that kind of a network to exist. So, yeah,
that's one of the things I'm very interested in. Is do we need to change any of our antitrust laws to in the state to make that easier for these different groups that aren't together right now?
I think if based on earlier testimony, I think it is a hindrance right now.
Yeah. Other questions?
Yes.
Yeah,
Mr.
Chairman. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I thought the reason why I also want to hear that clinical integration and your comment was also that you didn't have all the specialties. And I think of North Memorial in particular that has really driven a trauma specialty and has done a lot of rural connections. They've been very effective in their particular taking an expertise and making a lot of connections. And even though they could be very far away, they've still managed to share the expertise and to do that and a variety of things, whether it's staffing or a variety of things or just some expertise that they do that I thought was interesting too, that you don't have to have them all in order to integrate or meet some of those needs. I think the challenge too for some of these things is that there's an open door cost. It costs so much just to have one patient come in the door. Mm-hmm. Because you have to have certain things, there's certain basic costs, and so the critical mass of doing that, but this is where the value is. The more, almost like a grocery store, the more varied things that you have, value is, the more, almost like a grocery store, the more varied things that you have, the more the checkout lanes, they process a lot of things. But I think do you see that some of the things that you are doing, that when we're talking here about ACOs or CCOs, you called it clinical integration. Could this kind of step into something like an ACO or a CCO?
Yeah, I believe the network, Mr. Chair, Representative Kissman, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with protocol here very well. That's our desire. We believe that this clinically integrated network is what allows us to be what people are defining as an accountable care organization. I think my comment back would be that it's the pace at which an organization can ready itself for that. Mm-hmm. I think some organizations can get out of the chute too fast and too far and shoot themselves in the foot, and that's what's tricky. So I think we know it's going to take time to build the infrastructure and take over some of the things that the health plans have been doing, such as care management. I think when you bring that closer to the patient-physician relationship, you're going to be a lot more effective. But we can't build that overnight because we're not reimbursed for it right now. And at the same time, so you almost have to pace the payment reform with the ability of the provider organizations to build up the infrastructure and actually be effective. And I think that's one of our issues with the GAMC. It's just too fast. We can't be ready that quick.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. And just in regards to some of those things, one of the things that I've come to believe in is in our Minnesota people that they really have a compassionate heart. They want to. And one of the things that I think that we can do is the incentive-driven, you know, market. You get what you pay for kind of a thing. And if you're always paying the highest value for those very top level and you don't take care of your primary care and don't compensate them for that kind of coordination and all that, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that we might be able to help speed up or help do that is making sure that as we're doing this that coordinated care gets compensated for, the act of coordinating or structuring that in some way, because otherwise we're topsy-turvy on the whole thing and the market will then always go to that which has the greatest compensation, which isn't always in the best interests of the patients.
Some of us should go up to the hospital clinic in Staples, Minnesota. They merged their clinic with their hospital 10 years ago, and I asked the CEO, how did you merge those two cultures? And he said it took 10 years. It's a long time to change how people view the world. We'd like him to do it overnight, but it's not going to happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no doubt about it, that is a challenge, and having been on a hospital board for 4 years, where we do, and we are moving towards, you know, in the area where I am, in a publicly owned hospital that straddles two counties. It is a challenge, but one of the things that really does take, Dr. Whelan, and I think we all see that, is leadership for one thing, and really seeing that, being sensitive to that. But I think for us in the legislature, it is more of incentives and driving all of that helps support that happening. Just for that.
And I would just follow up that the most amazing thing to me is how good our healthcare system is, given the incentives that they have in place. It ought to be a lot worse. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your testimony. And next we're going to Lawrence Massa from the Hospital Association. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our state's 147 hospitals and 17 health systems. I think you've touched on this already. Minnesota's healthcare system is a rarity on the national landscape. Better care for less cost. To be sure, improved quality and affordability are huge issues here as well. But publicly available data show our providers consistently deliver higher quality care and achieve better outcomes for our patients than our peers around the country. Our per Medicare beneficiary costs are lower than the national average, not just in certain communities, but in every hospital referral region in the state, according to ongoing research from the Dartmouth Atlas. And unlike health systems in almost every other state, we have both deeper and broader integration of our healthcare delivery system, as well as a culture of multi-stakeholder collaboration. No healthcare market in the country may be better suited to take on the challenge, navigate the implementation, and deliver the hopeful results associated with accountable care organizations. The new federal healthcare reform law gives authority to the Department of Health and Human Services to begin paying for Medicare and Medicaid services through accountable care organizations beginning in 2012. The Minnesota Hospital Association believes that our state should take the steps necessary not only to prepare for, but to lead and help design the new payment and delivery model. Accordingly, we support the amendment language presented. At the same time, we recognize that accountable care organizations and the statutory and regulatory framework necessary for their success are far from simple or easy, as has been testified to already today. So we respectfully offer a few suggestions for the committee's consideration. First, because of the complexity of today's healthcare laws and regulations and the number of changes that might be necessary to bring ACOs online, we would like to see stakeholder representation in the future development of ACOs, perhaps in a legislatively directed interim work group, for example. Next, we believe that a key element of the success of this effort depends upon its voluntary adoption rather than mandatory implementation. And I must respectfully disagree with Representative Murphy on this. On a relatively short timetable and with numerous unanswered questions, it seems to us reasonable to begin with willing early adopters on a voluntary basis. It will take some time. Finally, we believe that a key to the success of an accountable care organization structure will be its flexibility, and this has been discussed this afternoon as well. We want to leave the doors open to create a different ACO models so they can seed in both rural and urban communities for fully integrated systems as well as new independent provider collaborations or providers willing to explore virtual integration alternatives. In other words, it is important that we abandon a one-size-fits-all perspective at the outset and leave ourselves the necessary room to create a framework that will bend and adapt to our community's differing needs, resources, and attributes. We suggest that the legislature allow for greater latitude in the definition of what services are available an accountable care organization provides and how such services are priced. We fully expect this model to include comprehensive services. However, it is possible that ACOs will be more successful and achieve greater efficiencies if some outlier services or conditions are paid for through different structures. It is also possible that ACOs will be more successful if purchasers like the state and large ERISA plans have a greater array of pricing and payment mechanisms than those that were intended for baskets of care. In the end, Minnesota's hospitals and healthcare systems are eager to lead in the exploration of accountable care organizations, and we believe that this legislation lays important groundwork toward bringing those models and the efficiency and quality improvements they offer to the communities and patients we serve. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions for Dr. Massa? Must have been really clear. So thank you for your testimony, and I, as I've said the other day, we're going to have a lot of work to do this summer, fall, winter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No question about it.
Dr. David Mullen from Fairview.
And good afternoon, Chairman Huntley and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Dave Mullen. I'm Medical Director of Care Model Innovation at Fairview Health Services. My background is 20 years of practicing emergency medicine. That's a great place to see what's wrong with American healthcare. Most people in emergency departments don't really want to be there, and they don't have emergencies. It's a symptom of a greater problem that we're addressing in health reform. We're here to support the legislative language that would move the state toward accountable care organizations and keep our efforts in line with the federal work that's going on in this regard. We think the ACO allows us a unique opportunity to align the clinical model, in other words, the way we provide care, with the business model, the way care is paid. Our position is not to wait for the payment reform to happen, but to venture forward because we think we have a responsibility to the community to provide leadership in this area. We think the value and the difference between the HMO movement and the ACO movement is actually the reform is taking place in how care is delivered, not how it's paid for. Ultimately, care needs to be paid for differently, but the focus for us is really on providing care differently and finding value. What we have discovered in our work, we have the Egan Clinic, which you've probably read about, where we've taken physicians and nurse practitioners off of the RVU model and allowed them to provide care in the way they think it's appropriate to provide it. And amazingly, they're finding value. Care is migrating to the telephone, to email. Patients are no longer coming in for services they don't need because we aren't counting the clicks we get paid for every time they come in. And this has given us tremendous information about where the value really is, and it's allowing us to redesign our compensation system for physicians and actually align it to contracting strategies and other payment methodologies that'll take us to the value we all seek. We have now expanded to 4 clinics that are in this model and have plans to move this model across all of our clinics in the Twin Cities. We're very confident that we're going in the right direction. We don't have all the answers yet, but the primary care model needs to provide more value. We can't just pay primary physicians more for work that today is not producing the kind of value that needs to be produced in that space. Today's model does not allow primary care clinicians to produce value in the way they need to. By taking them off this payment treadmill, they have discovered value. The tenets of our innovation work is that the best solutions lie in the minds of patients and clinicians. Yesterday we had 20 ovarian cancer patients and their families meeting with physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and therapists who work with people with cancer. And we had them tell us how to fix the system. We had them share their experiences about the gaps they experience in care. 99.9% of a person's experience with cancer is not in our facilities. It's at their home and in their life. And we learned a lot yesterday. We also believe in the importance of thriving in new partnerships, both with patients but also other organizations. The Medica agreement that we have is a good example of how we've partnered with a payer to actually bring some capital into the system to support the kind of change that we're undergoing. We have also, yesterday, we're partnering with Health Partners and also the University of Minnesota in this Project Melody, which is the work with ovarian cancer patients. What we believe is that we alone can't take on this problem, that we are all going to have to think differently. That includes the government, payers, employers, the public, and us, and that the only way we're going to go forward is through collaborative efforts like we've been doing. Are the slides up? I need to do the slides. Well, Mary, sorry about that. That would be great. I think you do. I'm a doctor. I'm not real good on the computer. What I want to show you is a slide that really demonstrates the challenge that Dr. Whelan was referring to, and that is that we're in a fee-for-service model, and the very things that we're talking about needing to reduce or eliminate are the very things that we make money on. And so we need to transition in the right way, but we have a goal to reach the ACO operating model by 2012. And we're on our way to that goal. And what we're finding is that, again, putting the clinicians in a leadership role and having them partner with patients is where we're really uncovering value. And that's teaching us more and more about how the payment needs to be structured to support the value they're creating. I guess we're not going to have a slideshow. So this transitional period is really an important time. It's really a cultural change for an organization like ours that has been a reliability organization to shift to an organization that is trying things that may not work, engaging with partners that have been our competitors, talking to payers in ways we've never spoken to them, needing to fund this transition with different partnerships than we've ever had before. But that is what is getting us through the transition. And we feel an obligation to move quickly to a new system, and we feel an obligation to lead. We think health systems have the knowledge necessary to take us to the next level. And that is why we're pursuing the strategy we are. During the transitional period, I just want to share a little bit about some of the care models that are emerging. One, we have work with integrative providers, so chiropractors, physical therapists, acupuncturists, really looking at For patients with low back pain, where is the value really created? For a first visit, it's not created with an orthopedist or a neurologist. It's actually created by working with other providers who don't have a surgical training. There's lots of value that can be created, and what we're doing is challenging our providers to figure that out. What is the best way through low back pain, and how do we design a system that navigates patients to value, not just to services, to value? And we're finding that we're uncovering value, again, by putting providers in the position of leading. The other thing we've done is moved into the virtual care space. You'll see us seeing patients through the internet using webcams when appropriate. We're also doing medication management through the internet with pharmacists and starting to do some health coaching that way as well. We see the internet as an underdeployed resource. We see that it's not for everybody, but we think it's an important part of the array of ways that people can access care and services in the future. We also see the cell phone as a reliable way to access care, and it will be part of the care delivery system of the future. A lot has been said about the medical home and the value of that. I think the medical home is a key component of the accountable care organization. The medical home is really where an individual's needs are met, but it's translated into a population health context. So people operating in the clinic need to begin to understand who's in their population, who's at risk, what kinds of new services are needed for patients that are high risk. Patients at the very highest risk benefit from in-home daily contact. And we can demonstrate that the costs will be decreased if we actually increase the care that's delivered proactively to patients. I think in the HMO model, we got stuck in trying to use the same model of care to deliver value, and it didn't happen because I don't think we ever really changed care. The other thing we have today that's different is much more sophisticated population analytics that can really tell us where value is when it comes to diabetes or hypertension or heart disease. And these analytics can fuel our efforts to meet people where they are and provide different services. So I think we'll just skip the presentation, and I'm ready for questions.
Representative Slavik.
We do have the charts in hand if you wanted to see them that way. I'm just encouraged to hear that all the different things that you're doing and all the different things you're trying, and I don't know as much as everybody else on this committee, but I think because I'm not on the policy side, I'm only on finance. So if you're looking at this one, it does look like there's such a variety out there and the potential to save money and give good care at the same time.
Yeah, there is that potential, and it's all about engaging patients and clinicians and actually finding the value and supporting them and removing the barriers. A very interesting thing is the electronic health record has been a great tool, but the way it's been used in a lot of systems, it's actually decreased efficiency and increased cost and also diminished the patient experience. It's not fun to sit and have your doctor typing while you're talking about, you know, chest pain. And I just think that what we've discovered in the innovation clinics is that we have actually dragged physicians into the infrastructure and nurse practitioners and other providers into the infrastructure of care delivery with the electronic health record. They are actually taking 90 minutes of take-home work home a day. And if you think that makes for happy clinicians, it doesn't. The clinicians figured out a way to get rid of all that work in 30 days by empowering other members of the team. And what that did is really reinforce the notion that relying on team members in my clinical setting actually makes my life better. And that's an important thing for physicians to learn.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Moen, thank you. But it's really encouraging to hear you you speak and talking about when the clinicians are typing on a computer. I know where I work, usually my back is also to the patient while I'm typing on the computer during that interaction, which is not a good thing. I was curious how long you've changed from the RVU system and if you've seen and I'm assuming you have, an increase not just in quality, but patient and provider satisfaction. And also, one more, if I can.
Yeah.
I know because of the economy, it might be tough to tease this out, but production overall, what has happened? And I don't know if you've been in the new system long enough or if you're tracking that.
We're tracking all those things, and they're extremely important. What we're seeing is the provider's biggest concern that are in these clinics is that we're going to go back to the old model. And it's all about trust. Providers have been sold a lot of stuff in the last 40 years, and frankly, I think part of our dilemma we're facing is because as providers, we really haven't provided the degree of leadership necessary to really drive the model where it needs to go. So the provider experience is huge, and the ones that are involved in the clinics are the ones that are telling the rest of the clinics that they need to go, that this is a much better way to be. Patients are telling us it's much better. When they call in, they don't go through massive phone trees. Up to 30% of our phone calls were abandoned in our clinics prior to the change. And that's dropped dramatically with the change as the phones have been changed to flow into the teams that are caring for these patients. And team members are co-located so they can share information instead of being in cubicles and hitting send buttons. The send button is a very common thing in healthcare to deal with too much work with too little time. And we're trying to eliminate the send button, and sometimes the person at the end of the send button, I mean, it's actually a person at the end of the send button, and we're really trying to have people take more accountability for the experience, the cost, and the outcome. We have seen a change in the productivity in some of our clinics with the new model. As we've distributed the work to different team members, what we've found in one clinic that is particularly taken this to a new level is that they're actually seeing touching more lives and more efficient than they were before the change. I think the key was we didn't go into this knowing the answer. We went into it believing that the clinicians had the answer and that we needed to support them in finding it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any, so I thank you very much for your presentation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Ida Wooster. Is she around? Oh, there she is. The second Duluth native to testify before this committee today.
Good afternoon, Chairman Huntley and members of the committee. As most of you know, I'm working for UCARE. I guess I should say my name first, Gita Wooster. I'm the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing at UCARE. We are a nonprofit health plan serving over 100,000 members on state public programs in the state, a little over 10,000 that are in special needs plans that are dual eligible recipients, and 75,000 Medicare Advantage members. We're the largest Medicare Advantage risk plan in the state, and as Representative Huntley said before, that's part of about one-third of the individuals that are in some kind of coordinated Medicare plan. We believe we're a good financial steward of the government funds that we receive, and we appreciate the opportunity to comment today. I think there's two parts to what we want to talk with you about today. First, we want to support the fact that there is value in the formation of the Accountable Care Organization as a model of care for the hospital and clinic systems working in the state. We've got several hospital and clinic systems, actually, that we work with that we're here today presenting, and others that have been working with us in shared risk models that look at both the quality and cost structures for the providers. It was nice to hear you mentioning some of the Medica models. I want to share with you that we are doing the same type of shared risk, but we weave in the quality, and as you've probably seen the way Medicare is looking at paying for health plans in the future, the quality components are extremely important here with their STAR system and looking at HEDIS measures that look at quality service measures, complaints, appeals, grievances, that kind of area. So it's becoming more and more important for all of us. And we think our role as a health plan has value in this. A second part that I think is important, as we look at RC 155 as an amendment, we did not understand it the way, Representative Huntley, you were describing it today. And so it...
That will be completely rewritten.
Thank you very much. Because we think there is a very valuable role for the health plans in working with the hospital and clinic systems that you've been hearing from today. Some of our roles may change. The Allina conversation about doing more with care coordination, for example, when we started back in 1984 doing the prepaid medical assistance system, we actually used more of a gatekeeper model, and we used the term medical home. And systems moved away from that system of care and using the term gatekeeper, I think in part because the word sounded horrible. It sounded like you were preventing things from happening. And it's wonderful to hear the systems talk about really wanting to be accountable for risk and accountable for the quality among the services that they are able to provide. A second point that we have is, while building on federal reform, we have concerns in building too much on the ACO model that's being developed for Medicare. The average age of our Medicare Advantage members is 74, and the average age of our prepaid medical assistance members are 15. And so we want to make sure that the quality measures and the structure of the program is set up in an appropriate manner. Also, federal reform tries to look at keeping people covered for a longer period of time. And in the prepaid medical assistance program, we have on average 6 to 12 months of individuals on some of those programs. And it's very hard for the systems to look and be accountable for the long-term costs of those recipients and really make the changes that are necessary unless we keep individuals in the systems for a longer period of time. Also, we think that aligning with the federal reform models that are coming out so that we work with the way the exchange is going to be built and model things appropriately so that our providers can look and see the patients coming into their clinic over years of service as they go, maybe starting out in a prepaid medical assistance program and moving into the exchange, is incredibly important, and we stand ready to work to try to make sure that that kind of model is something that can be developed here. I think you've heard a message from folks today that we need to go slow and make sure we do this right. The systems like Fairview that we've been working with for years, we have risk-sharing arrangements that look at quality and cost in the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program and in the UCare for Seniors program that's Medicare Advantage. Models like that with other hospital and clinic systems are starting out, but the risk is narrow and the quality measures are under definition. And as we look at better risk adjustment models, I think we need to be very cautious there. We also want to encourage multiple different models and hope that that is something that we can achieve with this. And I think from the testimony you've heard today, there's a lot of different ways Fairview and Allina are not going to develop the same models, and that's good to give some differences out there. And then to have measurement that works appropriately here. So... we're supportive.
One of the things that I like about accountable care organizations is that we give them the money and we say, you figure out the best way to spend it. And then we hold them accountable for the results. Because I don't want to sit here in the legislature and say, this is the way this disease should be treated. That's not our role. And I agree with you 100% that I hope they're all different. Then we find out which one is the best. So, questions? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't agree more. We don't want to be in the business of prescribing how. And I think that is a very important thing. I think it's easy in the legislature to get into that field of it. But I think our power is in that incentive, financial incentives, to match up to that, to those results. One of the questions that you mentioned had to do with Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Do you have any idea of what percent of Medicare recipients also pay extra for the Medicare Advantage program? Because I think a lot of people think that Medicare just does all this stuff and don't realize that there are people who pay extra under Medicare Advantage or gap insurance, a variety of other tools that pick up some of these things, and it isn't just straight Medicare just because they're 65 and older. But do you have a sense of the percentage that do either for your population or for, if you know, any national or Minnesota percentages?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but when you take the cost plans in Minnesota and the Medicare Advantage plans, we all have some type of premium in those plans that individuals pay for. There are some private fee-for-service plans in the state that are also Medicare options with slightly lower benefit packages and different types of access services that have lower premiums. And then there's the supplement business that is very much alive and well in our state, and in that case people do pay a premium there as well. Unfortunately, we're not like the state of Florida or some parts of Texas where individuals are able to get a higher benefit package and have zero premium there. So most individuals that choose a supplement type of program have some type of premium that they're paying for that service here in the state.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you. I think that I know you've talked about this before and addressed it, the inequity, and that what we're fighting hard for is to see to it we don't get penalized going forward, and that there's greater equity between states like Florida that get a huge compensation for the same fractured hip that in Minnesota is much less. And I really don't know that needs to be. So I'm glad to hear you've talked about that before, too, and going forward with that. But I think that's an interesting thing that down in a state like Florida, they get a better benefit package and a zero premium. Do you have a sense of why that is? I mean, is it because they do get reimbursed higher so they can afford to not have to charge the premium?
In the state of Florida, the premium that a Medicare Advantage plan gets for an 80-year-old male, and just to keep it as a comparison, is more like $1,350. And in the county of Ramsey, the same individual would receive something in the neighborhood of $850. It's based on an old formula that looks at the utilization of services and the payment cost structure for providers in that area. And it's not looking at quality of care. We did an analysis to look at the number of high star value plans. That's how Medicare does it, on a 5-star rating. And plans getting $1,300 in Florida were 2.5-star plans, while most of the plans in Minnesota are 4 and 4.5-star, in the top quartile of all plans in the country here.
Great facts and information, isn't it? And go Minnesota, but I think also go Minnesota in that we get more fairly compensated, or that there's some equality comes into this. That'll be very important. We have an opportunity here to do that, so I hope we do get, I hope we get that result.
So do I. Any other questions? I don't see any. So thank you very much for your testimony. And next we're going to have Dr. Doug Wood from the Mayo Clinic, who's been before this committee many, many times.
Thank you, Representative Huntley, members of the committee. It is a privilege to be back before you. It's been a personal privilege of mine to work with several of you on other projects of a common interest dating back several years. The Mayo Health Policy Center over the last 2 years has identified that the country needs to achieve progress on four major fronts for us to achieve transformative health care reform. And the discussion that we've been having today in this committee and the consideration of the bills that are before this committee and in this legislature, I think, position Minnesota to be on a leading edge of the intersection of these four cornerstones of reform. The four cornerstones of reform from the Mayo Health Policy Center put two in the domain of providers and two in the domain of government. The two in the domain of providers happen to be the creation of value and coordination of care. The two that are in the domain of government happen to be the creation of mechanisms to reward value and finding ways that we can provide affordable insurance for all citizens. Now, obviously, the great possibility of intersection here is the linkage of creation of value and pay for value but with a corollary benefit of helping to achieve affordable coverage for our citizens. And the impact on the budgets of the state and the impact on the budgets of the federal government, as well as the impact on the pocketbooks of individual citizens, is not small. So as we look at this circumstance, we believe that there is a tremendous opportunity for us to move forward, and we're anxious to be able to help the state of Minnesota move forward. We believe that the concept of accountable care organizations, in fact, provide tremendous opportunities. And as we think about those opportunities, we would offer a few thoughts for consideration. The one is that we need to be flexible. Although the concept of an accountable care organization as it was conceived by Elliot Fisher and some others working at MedPAC was that we would try to create systems of care that would allow us to achieve the same results in outcomes or quality that have been characteristic of large systems across the country. Mayo, Intermountain Healthcare, and Dartmouth in particular have been working on a project called High Value Healthcare, which is simply aimed at creating an accountability again of organizations to produce results. The expectations here would be different than they have been in the past. So the expectation going forward is that we produce health. We don't produce health care. So the best health is fewer days in a hospital. And in the testimony that we've heard earlier today, we have heard indeed that the way that the current system is organized is that we try to pay for hospital care. What we need to pay for, again, is health. But hospitals can be tremendously valuable resources, especially because they are usually the locus of most of the healthcare resources in the community, along with their provider network. We should be able to take advantage of our existing resources and reformat them in a way that would produce health for our communities. The incentives need to be there for providers. The incentives need to be there for organizations like hospitals. But the incentives, I think, also have to be there for patients. So if we simply do this from the perspective of saying we want to do this by putting incentives in place for providers and hospitals, and we don't understand how they relate to the needs of patients, I doubt that we will be successful. And I believe that's one of the reasons, in response to the question that was raised by Representative Abler earlier, that HMOs have never been able to achieve their true potential. So one of the projects that I do, besides being a practicing cardiologist, I'm the chair of healthcare policy and research at Mayo, and I work in the Center for Innovation, and I'm working on a project in Austin, Minnesota to completely redesign the care. We embedded cultural anthropologists in Austin for about 4 months to understand exactly what happens in the way that citizens look at health and health care services. The first thing we learned was that citizens don't think of health like we do in medicine. So if you think about the World Health Organization or the Institute of Medicine definition of health care, it's a big fancy definition, and it starts out with something like a disease management approach. Ordinary citizens think of health: can I maintain my role? Can I do the things every day that I need to do so that the people who depend on me will know that I'm there? We also found that even for those who are insured, they typically don't go to the doctor when you think they might, and the reason is because it's too scary, it's too complex, and it costs too much. Now, our goal here is to think about how we can create a new delivery system that will solve those problems. And in particular, an ACO gives us a structure that might allow for a great deal of flexibility in achieving some of these solutions. The other reason for us, I think, to maintain flexibility is that although conceptually the ACO, as offered by Fisher and his colleagues originally, is focused around a hospital, it doesn't have to be. It's quite possible that you could focus an ACO around a delivery group. For example, a large primary care group, maybe even a large group of pediatricians. And so from that perspective, as we move forward, I think we need to maintain some degree of flexibility. Flexibility in financial modeling, I think, is also important. Though shared savings is the concept that is often used in this circumstance, it might be possible for us to take a different approach, where we simply articulate to the providers that we're looking for value, and that the degree that you can produce value, you are likely to be rewarded by better payment and a higher market share. But if we're clear about the expectations and the goals of measurement match those expectations, and the incentives line up all across the board, all the way to the patients, then I think we can be quite successful in that regard. Current federal reform also gives us many opportunities, but there are some unknowns there. The regulations, for example, haven't been written, but there are some new opportunities. The CMS Office for Innovation gives us some chances, perhaps, that we would not have otherwise experienced. So it's important for us to, in this circumstance, I believe, not move so slowly, because we might miss the opportunity to stay in a leadership position and access lots of resources that could come to us. But to be open and flexible and move quickly to try to take advantage of those particular resources. I also hope that we can avoid narrow definitions and narrow populations. One of the considerations here is that if we think about CCDS, it's an entirely too narrow population. So you heard Mr. Scandrett, and I think Mr. Massa and Dita Wooster and others talked about trying to maintain a more flexible and broad approach, because the approach is really the same in terms of delivery system. You try to find those things you need to meet individual patient needs, but a delivery system works best when it has a single mission. The concept that was offered by Dr. Mullen, I think, of achieving clinical integration rather than financial integration is, at this point, the most important. And that's really been something that we have learned at Mayo in our work over the years. So it seems to me that we're in an ideal position to move forward. From our perspective, we would suggest that if we could continue brainstorming and move quickly, Commissioner Backstrom had mentioned the May 18th meeting. That may give us a good opportunity to think about how we might move forward. I know that Chairman Huntley has been interested in the possibility of getting groups back together. That could help us do some good brainstorming, I think, that would accomplish our goals fairly quickly. I believe that we should be crystal clear in setting targets. So in particular, we should set for ourselves reasonable spending targets. And we need to make it clear that providers in particular need to produce health at a reasonable cost. Though we could talk about shared savings, that's a little bit amorphous, and to some degree those groups that have been the most inefficient and perhaps the most ineffective stand to gain the most from the concept of shared savings. And here I think it's reasonable to say for those groups that have been most effective, give them a bit more power to go forward, because they will understand the concept of getting the kind of care of the kind of care produced for the cost that in fact we want to achieve. So all of those things I think are doable, and from our perspective, the faster that we move forward to take advantage of some federal opportunities, the better that we might be. You might know that Mayo decided not to be a CCDS. But from our perspective, the reasons are many, but one is that it's a bit of a distraction in the sense that we think that the ACO approach is a much more important and effective approach across the board for the future, and that's where we, in fact, want to concentrate our further development efforts. So the hour is late. I will stop there and see if there are any specific comments or questions that I might be able to answer or respond to, and appreciate the chance to come back before the committee.
Dr. Wood, do we have ways to sufficiently do risk adjustment now? So one of the problems with this thing is you have a lot of sick patients and the clinic down the street doesn't. Do you think we can adjust for that?
I think there are ways that we can risk adjust, and there are ways that we can understand what the burden of illness might be so we can project what spending should be and appropriately should be. We may need to do some more intense work on that as we learn more from the provider peer grouping project. So next year, as we start to get the data in provider peer grouping, that will give us a pretty substantial opportunity to look at how we might set some reasonable targets for spending. We'll have the combination of both the quality data and the spending data. And if we are able to provide the right resources for the Department of Health to get the analysis done, or at least give an expectation to them about the kinds of analysis that we need. That's more work for you, Carol. But I think that's one of the ways we can actually use what we're going to get out of the provider peer grouping to help us move forward in understanding what goals we might give for ACOs, for example.
And what kind of process do you think the state would need to move ahead? I mean, I'm talking about this summer, fall, and early winter.
Personally, I would suggest we perhaps do something similar to what we did a few years ago, and that is get a couple of small groups working fairly quickly to define exactly what we would like to accomplish in the broad space of ACOs, putting forward some specific goals, some specific targets, and the structures that we would need to do that. There were some other comments that were made, including things like looking at what other regulatory changes might we need to do. Are there some antitrust things we might have to consider? Are there some safe harbors we might have to consider? So that's a fair amount of work that we'd have to accomplish, and it might be best to charge some specific subcommittees with several of those to get them together and bring them back in a way that is timely. In that circumstance, then I think we'd be in a position to move at least from a legislative perspective into the next session, but we also have to think about then our interaction with CMS. So the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, in terms of interacting with CMS, will have some other deadlines that they'll have to meet. So we'll also have to make sure that we're working pretty carefully with those state agencies that have to move forward to match the federal requirements. So it's going to take, from my perspective, a lot of integration in that regard.
Yeah, I would also say that this is a little different than 2007 because of the insurance part of it. I mean, the huge part of the national health care reform involves insurance and regulation. So when we did the stuff in 2007, we didn't get much from the Commerce Committee. But that's going to be a much bigger issue.
That's true.
Other questions? Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is not an appropriate question to ask, but you talked, and thank you for your comments. They were great. Talking about, you know, as we move forward and we're thinking about how healthcare is changing and needing to have providers understand that that providing high-value healthcare produces health and what that means. And there's also the mindset of the patient. And you touched on that a little bit, but you know there are a lot of patients out there who feel ripped off if they're not given a prescription or you're not ordering that MRI. So how are you dealing with that? And I think some of that happens in the interaction with the patient and the provider, but other public policies, or because I think it's a bigger societal issue and education that's going to have to go on if we're all going to be moving forward and be successful.
Dr. Wood.
There are several ways I think that you deal with that. The first, again, is to create a set of shared expectations. So if our goal in an ACO is to achieve better health at a lower overall cost, then the first thing we have to do is to convince everybody that less is more. Now, that prescription that you want, well, you know, there's a chance that it might make you worse. That CT that you want, well, that's a lot of radiation that you're exposed to, and if you keep having those, there's a greater chance you're going to end up with cancer in 10 or 20 years. Or that angioplasty you said you thought you wanted, you know, if you do that, there's about a 200% increase in likelihood that you're going to have another one that you maybe didn't need in the first place. And by the way, if you don't use that, then ultimately your costs are less. Because if you do that and your neighbor does that and your coworker does that and we all become actually more conscious that we have a finite set of resources, then we all do better in that regard. So it's a huge effort, but ultimately I think healthcare providers have to lead it and we have to be aggressive with it and we have to make sure that everybody understands that more care is not necessarily better care. The right care is the best care.
Great. Other questions? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comments and insights. And as I was going along with this, when you mentioned the question of health care, what that is, and sometimes less of these procedures is the better, more healthier choice. But when I think of measurements of health, I think of coordinated care organizations or accountable care would strive towards some benchmarks of a body weight or blood chemistry norms or some other kinds of things that to me speak more to health than necessarily taking care of disease situations, mainly because we've all found that those are the kinds of things that lead us to need less, and that if we are more conscious of that, And I think, too, the in responding to that, but the other thing is incentives. I hear a lot about incentives and private care and other things, but patient incentives. I know here in Minnesota we have level 1, 2, 3, and you pay less copay. Based upon those, have been quite successful in our costs as a self-insured state of Minnesota, because you gave the patient a very tangible thing of less copay and yet gave them those choices. So where do you see incentives for patients, and then also the definition of health, and how might that fit into some of this accountable care?
Dr. Wood.
Thank you. So I will try to be brief because this is a pretty complicated subject. But let me just say at the beginning that we have a mounting number of studies that suggest that the traditional measures that we have used, including things like laboratory tests, for example, glycosylated hemoglobin, which is a measure of how well your blood sugar is controlled, are probably not as relevant as we thought they were. And the reason is because we have used those tests generally to say that we want to achieve a certain level of that test alone as a surrogate of the quality of health care. It doesn't measure the quality of health. So what we've seen in the last 2 years, there have been 3 studies for diabetes, 1 study for atrial fibrillation, and another study for high blood pressure, that suggest that our previously held thoughts that you should be very aggressive in getting the lowest blood pressure, the lowest hemoglobin A1C, the lowest blood sugar, the lowest heart rate, and atrial fibrillation are all wrong. You don't need to be that aggressive. By doing something that's less aggressive and more tolerable for patients, there are fewer side effects, fewer complications, fewer hospitalizations for the complications. And not so coincidentally, the health, that is how well you're able to function, is probably better. And if you think about it, if you're not having complications of the treatment, you're probably more comfortable. But our measurements so far have not included patient-reported outcomes. We have not asked the simple question of patients, for example, how many days in the last year were you limited by physical or emotional problems? We don't ask that. Now, the reason we don't ask that, there are lots of physicians who say that's too soft a measure. You have to have something that's risk-adjusted, hard outcome measure, hard laboratory measure. But in reality, there is a science that is behind the issue of, or behind patient-reported outcomes. We just haven't used them clinically. So we're beginning to push forward with an effort that will begin to look more at those patient-reported outcomes that will measure health. Because again, health is your ability to function in your role as an individual. And you could then look at an outcome that is as simple as the lack of hospital days. So you could pretty well assume that if you didn't spend any days in the hospital, you're pretty comfortable. Or you're dead, one or the other. So measures of hospital mortality. I mean, when you talk to people in the community, this is one thing we learned in Austin. I mean, a measure of mortality in a hospital doesn't make a lot of sense because they don't want to be in the hospital. It's not what they're thinking about. It's important for them to stay out of the hospital. So if we change the expectations of the delivery system and say, okay, our goal is to keep you out of the hospital. Now, there may be, Mr. Mouse is probably overthinking, there may be fewer hospitals. And there might be. But we actually may be using those hospitals in a different way. Rather than being oriented toward inpatient care, we use them as the foundation for health care in the community. Because we have, and especially from small communities, so if I go back to my experience in building primary health care systems in western Minnesota, in a small community like Springfield, then I've got a hospital in Springfield. Now, that hospital has inpatient care. It's a small hospital. But if I was back there today, I would look at this and say, I would like to look at this in a way I don't have to do inpatient care, but I want to use all the resources I have here to support the community. So if I applied new technologies, could I support patients at work, up the street at the Coleman factory, or across town at the nursing home? Or could I do things in school that I'm not currently doing? Or for some of my inpatient nurses that I don't need to do inpatient care, can they make home visits? If a lot of my care is obstetrical, is there a way that I can lessen the likelihood that I have a number of high-risk deliveries by doing better prenatal care at home? And an ACO then would give me the possibility of doing that because it would change the expectations and potentially the payment to go along with it. So even in areas like that, from my perspective, again, the power of an ACO concept is pretty powerful. But it would be, I would approach it, I can tell you from personal experience, differently in Little Springfield than I'm going to approach it in Rochester with my big Mayo system.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Well, that was very good comments. I think the other thing, though, is that the incentive, where do you see incentives for patients? I see incentives for providers. I see incentives for those who are paying. But true, real health in that regard has to include something for the person.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the incentive is, if we publish, for example, how well your system is doing in producing health, so you look at the system, so when maybe ultimately in provider peer grouping, we're not going to get there in the first year because we don't have the measurement in it, but ultimately when we get there, you would look at the information you have from systems and you would say, if I go to this system, you know, they don't use as many hospital days, and the patients all report that they feel better. And if I look at their total cost, it's actually the same as the system over here that has maybe a higher number of hospital days and a lower overall patient-reported outcome. So I can decide which way I want to go. But if my employer or payer is saying, you know, we're going to give you the incentive by having more money in your pocket to go with the high-value system, that might help you make that decision. Now, one of the things, again, in our Austin research, when we asked, you know, what? Why do you not go to the doctor? We heard, again, that it was too costly. Now, we didn't ask why it was too costly. But now, the possibilities are, well, I know if I go to the doctor, I got to pay a copay. I know if I go to the doctor, he's darn well going to order laboratory and x-ray and things like that, which sometimes I don't like to do because they're uncomfortable. Certain x-rays are uncomfortable. And I have another copay. And, you know, every time I go to that doctor, I'm going to get a prescription. And my prescription drug coverage is not good, and he prescribes the most expensive prescriptions anyway, and I can't afford it, so I'm not even going to bother because it puts me in a decision, it puts me in a bind to make decisions that I don't want to make, and I'll just forget that, and when I get bad enough, then I'll go, then it'll be worth it. So as we go through those, I think those are other things that we can get back to patients that would give them direct and measurable improvements in their health, as well as financial incentives that can help them make that decision.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you're exactly that. But I have seen, and we all know and experience ourselves, the Sunday paper comes out full of coupons. And I have seen how people, and I do this, I go through my local grocery store and I kind of look at the menus and go through everything. And it's kind of, if there's something in it that I enjoy the benefits of that extra effort. If you do, what's my incentive? And so I think there has to be a component that I too often don't hear, the side of the component, because I think there's just such a strong human dynamic that if we build that in, they most often, or at least we get to those percentages that do. Yeah. And there's always those few that no matter what won't.
So if you know then that your CT scan is going to cost you $4,000, it's not going to change the decision your doctor's going to make, and there's a 2% risk you're going to get something bad from it, that might change your thinking. But you don't have that information to make that decision now compared to how you buy your groceries. So give us a little bit of time with the provider peer grouping, and we build that into ACOs, then you've got something.
Don't have the information is exactly one piece of it, because I think people, especially I think our Minnesota people, want value. But I think also if their premium starts going down because of that, that is the sort of thing. But right now, it tends to be almost a perverse kind of a situation.
But there are some examples. Sorry, Representative Huntley, I'm too anxious. But I think there's some examples of how we can actually move that. Some of the best systems of care in Minnesota have, I think, been able to demonstrate that they can hold down the cost of care and keep premiums pretty steady year after year compared to what's happening in other states. But until it comes back to patients with something in their pocket, a reduced premium, lower copays, and maybe systems eliminating copays for certain things, I don't think we'll do as well as we could otherwise. So I agree with you entirely, but then that's the challenge, is how you do that.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. And now we're going to have very briefly Danette Bowman from Medica answer a question. And I will, Representative Kiffmeyer, this has been an interesting week in the news. I don't know if you noticed, but the United Healthcare, or High Health Group, which is a Minnesota corporation, is working out agreements with YMCAs all around the country to take their enrollees and get them exercising. And they figure, obviously, that that will save them money if they do that. So, Ms. Coleman, the question came up, can we put people on MA into a ACO? And it seems to me if they're in prepaid medical assistance, that would not be a problem. And do you have people already in some of these pilot projects that are on MA?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Danette Coleman with Medica. And to your question, Medica, as has been alluded to, has a number of our members in some form of payment reform model, whether that be an ACO, healthcare home, total cost of care. And within that, and we've partnered with a number of provider groups in this, we have found a number of willing providers and very progressive thinkers as far as how we need to move this. With regard to currently on Medicare and Medicaid, so I'll kind of group them together and reference them, our arrangements with a number of provider groups, none of them currently include Medicare and Medicaid from a contractual standpoint. However, our relationship with Fairview, for example, our contracts with SMDC and Park Nicollet and Allina, in as much as efficiencies are created in that exchange, how they're redesigning care, the Medicare and Medicaid enrollees, that benefit accrues to them. We have three care systems in the metro who are very interested in moving to total cost of care for specifically Medicaid. And actually, we have one that is very interested, and we believe that effective January 1st, 2011, we'll actually have a total cost of care contract for Medicaid with one rather large care system. So
we don't need a waiver for that.
Mr. Chair, we don't need a waiver. We don't need legislation. When this is done in a manner where DHS has a contract with the health plans, as you know, are at risk, which allows the health plans to enter into provider arrangements that are either fee-for-service, total cost of care, shared savings, all of that is possible under our current contracts with DHS and with our providers.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on that topic for Ms. Coleman? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony, and it was a nice day earlier today. The meeting is adjourned.